Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is William and I represent Yahoo here, the appellant, and both also the cross-appellee in this case. And with the Court's permission, I'll watch the clock. I'd like to reserve half my time for both the opposition as well as rebuttal later on. So this case involves an insurance policy. Yahoo purchased an insurance policy that required National Union to provide a duty to defend, which I'm sure the Court is familiar, requires the insurance company step in when a lawsuit is filed, hire attorneys.
Can I ask about that? Because I view it different than a duty to defend. It was really a duty to front initial cost to defend with the understanding that Yahoo would then reimburse for those costs. Isn't that different than a duty to defend contract?
Actually, Your Honor, and this is where we need to start with the policy, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's where the district court went awry. The district court went awry because it made that assumption going in when the express language of the policy in endorsement under personal injury specifically says that National Union has a duty to defend personal injury claims. It also says that the National Union has a duty to pay damages that allege personal injury. That is an entirely separate duty that's part of the insurance policy. Now,
so what about Yahoo's Yahoo's responsibility to reimburse for the fees? Because that seems, you don't disagree that that's in there, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is definitely in there, and it's.
But that seems to distinguish this case from kind of the more common case where there really is truly a duty to defend, in which case I don't think there'd be a question that Yahoo could get the full cost of defending the litigation. But
sure, Your Honor.
The fact that Yahoo has a responsibility and a contractual duty to reimburse, that is the wrinkle in this case.
No, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct about that. But again, the important part is you still have to look at the insurance policy language. What does the language say, and how do you interpret the insurance language? And if you read
if I can interrupt you for a moment, Zoom. So we've done that. We've all read the contracts and the record in your briefing, and I thank both counsel for your excellent briefing. So it seemed to me that National Union was not disputing breach. They don't dispute that they had a duty to defend covered claims. And we all know that there will sometimes be disputes between an insurer and an insured as to whether a claim is covered. And then, you know, if the insurer thinks it's not covered and they deny coverage, they can be in breach if they're wrong, right? So here, I respectfully disagree with Judge Nelson a little bit that I don't think the wrinkle or the issue is that National Union had a duty to defend. What was the expectation of these parties going into this contract? What did this contract provide? And what risk was transferred? Because to me, this is different from a general liability policy where all the risk is transferred to the insurer. And the insured pays a hefty premium for that. They pay a lot of money for the insurer to take the risk. But that didn't happen here. As we know from the information that was in the briefing, Yahoo paid a significantly reduced amount in premium because they retained the risk of the ultimate cost of defending litigation of any judgment or settlement. That's correct, right? That stayed with, assuming no breach, that stays with Yahoo, right?
Actually, Your Honor, I would disagree with you on that in this respect, and that is the policy did not get rid of National Union's duty to defend.
I agree. I'm not saying that they did. They had a duty to defend, and they could be in breach. And I don't see that they dispute that they were found to be in breach, and they're not appealing that. But if assuming there's no breach, I guess backing up a moment, and what does California law provide in contract interpretation? And I saw in your brief that you acknowledge insurance contracts are contracts, so we looked at contract law. And it seems to me it's pretty much black letter law in California that a breach of contract claim, as distinguished from, you know, a bad faith, breach of a covenant, a good faith and fair dealing, tort claim. Contract claim is to put the parties in the position they would have been in absent breach, right? Do you agree with that?
I do, Your Honor, and here's the rub, though, is it is virtually impossible to put the parties back in the position that they would have been, because it is not Yahoo who would have defended. It would have been National Union who would have defended. And
that's interesting. That's a very interesting argument, Mr. Newman. I appreciate the creativity of what you're suggesting, but as I read these contracts, if there's no breach, and that's the position we need to put the parties in, National Union would have paid the cost of defense, subject to being reimbursed and within either 15 or 30 days, depending on which document you look at. So this is pretty short term. It's not a year. It's not the conclusion of the litigation. It seems to be pretty quick. If there's no breach, I don't see any possible way for Yahoo to recover the $7 million or so that's seeking here, the cost of the defense and the settlement. If there's no breach, they don't get that, right? So it seems that you're trying to suggest that a breach means you get more than what the contract provided.
Here's what's important on this and why the cases allow for recovery of attorney's fees when there's a breach. It's obviously impossible to put the parties back because National Union and the insurer doesn't step up to the bat and provide a defense. But there's
There's another thing that happens, Mr. Newman, insurance pretty regularly, which is when an insurer provides a defense under a reservation of rights. And that creates a conflict between the insurer and the insured, in which case the insured has the right to seek independent counsel. And that actually happened in this case on the claims that National Union did accept. They did it so under a reservation of rights. It's a pretty common occurrence. So a party going into a contract, an insurance contract, knows there could be a reservation of rights. They could be finding independent counsel. Yahoo, in fact, did that here. And if the timeline that National Union has presented is correct, Yahoo interviewed and selected counsel of its choosing before even tendering the first claim to National Union. Yahoo went out and got the counsel it wanted, and they were very happy with their counsel. They weren't expecting National Union to hold their hand and lead them through the process. They wanted their own counsel, and they got them. So I don't know how that suddenly means that when there's a breach, Yahoo can recover $7 million that it couldn't have recovered absent a breach.
So here's an important fact that's missing from all of this, is the fact that they did not issue that reservation of rights when Yahoo was entering into this. That happened after the fact, and the court viewed that as a breach of contract under the policy.
No, I understand the timing. I know that was much later. But National Union's represented, and if they're wrong, please let me know, is that the very first two lawsuits, the one where Yahoo prevailed in having those suits dismissed, I forget the names of the plaintiffs, but there were two initial lawsuits that were in 2012, that Yahoo, in fact, interviewed four law firms, retained counsel of their choosing, and then tendered the defense to National Union. So they had already, if National Union is giving it to us straight, Yahoo had already gone out and selected their own counsel before even asking for coverage. They weren't relying on National Union to find their counsel for them.
I'm not sure that matters one way or another from a legal standpoint because of the fact that they denied coverage. And when you deny coverage, that doesn't change the impact. But I think the important part, let's focus on the coverage endorsement that really is at issue. And again, I'm glad the court recognizes that policy interpretation means the words of the endorsement. And what's very important about the endorsement is, on top of the fact that there is an obligation for Yahoo to reimburse after National Union pays. And we'll put that aside for right now because the court understands the circumstances. But there are other conditions in that document, in the coverage endorsement. One of them is the fact that National Union has to send an invoice, ask for reimbursement. That's one. But the other more important and why this is relevant is the fact that the endorsement has its own default and remedy provision that's in there. In other words, the remedy for National Union, that had National Union gone through the process, defended the case, paid the defense and the settlements like it was required to, it could rely on the endorsement to seek reimbursement. But if they sought reimbursement and Yahoo defaulted, didn't reimburse them back, the remedy is specifically mentioned in the endorsement that says, if you fail to perform, i.e. the reimbursement obligation, we, National Union, may cancel this endorsement or the policy at issue. Now, the reason why that's important is because this endorsement is a freestanding separate obligation between National Union and Yahoo. That I totally agree with the court so far about the idea that there is a reimbursement obligation.
Wait a minute. I have to back up for a minute, Mr. Room. I'm not sure how the endorsement, which is part of the policy, and says in all caps and bold letters at the top, this is part of your insurance policy, read this carefully, is somehow some separate document. The initial policy and the writer, the endorsement, they're read together, right? Don't we read those together?
Correct, Your Honor. And what I'm suggesting here, and I think what Yahoo's position has been, is the fact that the endorsement, the coverage deductible endorsement, is only available when there's a performing carrier, and because the carrier
I don't disagree with you. I think you're completely right that the only way National Union could recover reimbursement is if they pay. Right? So they have a provision that allows them to have reimbursement for defense costs and settlement costs, et cetera, judgments. But they got to pay it first so they don't get the reimbursement. But that's not what this case is about. National Union didn't sue Yahoo and say, hey, you owe us money. This is Yahoo suing National Union saying, you breached the contract, you did so in bad faith, and we're entitled to all sorts of damages for that, which in part is actually correct. But we're looking at those provisions to see what would happen absent breach, because that's what the case law tells us to do. So we have to put the parties in the position they would be in absent a breach. Absent a breach, National Union would have paid. Absent a breach on Yahoo's part, Yahoo would have reimbursed. So what are Yahoo's damages then?
So
the time value of money.
What I'm suggesting here, Your Honor, is the fact that if that's the case, then the obligation, the express obligation of the duty to defend and the duty to pay is unnecessary surplus language in the policy because...
No, it's not. Let me go back to basics with you, Mr. Rudd. Yahoo bought a policy that protected it for $1 million of loss subject to reimbursement at periodic intervals following invoice so that if the contract was carried out, Yahoo had a 15-day advance. They also had the opportunity to call upon the defense capabilities of an experienced insurance company. And they also had an obligation from the insurance company to pay all kinds of litigation costs. The agreement is very specific on that, subject again to a 15-day reimbursement. So I look at the end of this and I say, what is this argument of bad faith? A company which has a good faith ability to say, no, I'm not covered, is not obligated to cover. And so National Union did not front the money. But Yahoo carried on a defense. It was not prejudiced in the slightest. And it can't get more, as Judge Beatty said, than it would have gotten under the contract, which is a 15-day use of money. Where else is the damage?
So, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that Yahoo going out defending itself is the same as if National Union had to defend the case, because obviously that's what Yahoo contracted for. It's the fact that Yahoo is working.
You didn't pay. Here's the problem.
Yahoo's a big enough company to defend itself.
No, absolutely, Your Honor.
And you can't say that you were prejudiced because you carried on your own defense rather than call upon National Union.
The only comment I would make here is the one thing is the court doesn't have to guess about how this should be applied, because the only case that's out there in California is directly on point. It's the Kennedy decision.
Okay, I wanted to ask about that because Kennedy, I mean, let's set aside the fact that it's 70 years old. You know, it's two pages. It has very little analysis. Explain to me how that was a fronting policy, because it's not entirely clear to me. There does seem to be some language to support kind of the fronting policy, but it does seem to be a reimbursement policy where the insurer agreed to pay the defense costs. So Help me understand how that
applies. Mr. And I want you to answer Judge Nelson's question, but I want you to know something when you do that. And that is that I ran a Westlaw check on the Kennedy case to see every time it has been cited in the last 70 years. It's only 12 times.
Yes.
One of them is this case. Five of them are for the proposition that an insurance company can't deny coverage and then say you violated your requirement to give us notice of the claim. But what was interesting as I read through those cases and looked at the companion case, Giordano, I think it's called, is that Kennedy involved a PUC contract, right? Public Utility Commission contract, similar to the Federal Motor Safety Transportation Act, where common carriers, trucking companies, which is what these people were, are required to have certain coverage to protect the public. And that was the type of contract that was at issue. So it took a little digging to go find what this was, but it wasn't a fronting contract. It was an endorsement for a company.
Well, Mr. Judge Beatty, I appreciate it. Mr. I asked a question, and I'd appreciate if you could explain to us about Kennedy.
Sure, Your Honor. And first of all, on the idea that this is a fronting policy that everyone's assuming that it is, first of all, there's no language in the policy describing that it's a fronting policy, so I'll just respectfully disagree on that. The reason why Kennedy is directly on point is on the issue about the endorsement. Just like in our case, in Kennedy, there was an endorsement that if the insurer in that case had defended the case, didn't breach, that the insurer could have sought reimbursement under the policy, just like National Union is saying here. And what happened there was the fact that they breached their duty to defend and failed to defend, the court said, look, the damages that we're going to award here is the full cost that the policyholder, not the insurer, had to go out and defend. So let's see how we can put it into context here is, had the insurer defended there, they would have been able to get full reimbursement for the costs associated with the defense. And the reason why that's important and why I think the courts hold the way they do is the fact that the contract language says you have a duty to defend is very important, because if you have an endorsement that says you're entitled to reimbursement, the insurer can simply say, you know what?
Here's the problem. You keep relying on the duty to defend, but I think we need a hook. You didn't pay the premium that would normally be associated with what we understand to be a duty to defend contract. So there is a perception, right or wrong, that Yahoo, if we rule in your favor, would get a huge windfall simply because the insurance company made, it's not even clear it was bad faith. They just made a determination, turned out to be wrong up front, that they didn't have the duty to defend. So what is the hook for us to turn that into a $7 million windfall for you?
So let's be clear about this. Is the premium was the premium, even if it was less, it was the premium that required...
Yeah, but why doesn't that go into the expectation of the parties?
Because of the fact that the expectation...
If you're paying $100 for a premium that normally goes for $2,000 on the open market, why do you believe that you should get the benefit of the $2,000 premium provisions? Well, you just think they made a mistake?
No. What happened was the fact that they intentionally decided not to defend Yahoo, and the jury ultimately determined that it was done in bad faith, which is the determination that is not being challenged here, Your Honor. But the important part is Yahoo had an expectation that it didn't have to deal with these lawsuits, that National Union would step in and defend, and if it honored its obligation, that it would go and reimburse them. In other words, this is a nuisance that Yahoo didn't have to deal with. Again, we've got a big claim here, but there are other lawsuits under this policy where Yahoo gets sued, sends a notice letter, National Union steps in, defends it, and then sends us an invoice, and we reimburse them back. And I realize that the dollar amounts at issue have a potential challenge here, but the fact is that's what the policy language is, and that was the expectation. And the endorsement, again, going back to it, there are provisions in the endorsement that talk about if we don't reimburse, what the remedy would be. We could have not reimbursed them, and the endorsement would have disappeared. The policy would have been canceled. Those are expectations, and I don't want to be too technical about it, but the California Supreme Court requires a literal interpretation of the words of the policy. And the National Union didn't say, we're going to eliminate the duty to defend here. It expressly kept the duty to defend language in there, It kept the duty to pay language in there, and it had and added the endorsement. So it's very important that you do a literal reading of the policy. And this is not about a gotcha. This is a fundamental obligation of the carrier. And again, I would submit that the Kennedy decision is directly on point on it, because even in that situation where if the carrier had performed, their obligation would have been zero.
Did you consider Kennedy and Judge Nelson? I apologize, I didn't mean to hijack your question, but the reason I was pointing that out to you, Mr. is because I wanted to know when you answered Judge Nelson's question, if when you made that analysis, if you considered in the context of the California Public Utility Commission mandate under state law that a common carrier have an endorsement that would provide coverage for a claim to protect the public, but not necessarily a duty to defend. Did you look at that context and what that contract really was?
Yeah, I saw the same cases that you did as well, too, and agree with your assessment on it. But keep in mind the fact that the court, the endorsement did require duty to defend, and they allowed the insurer to seek reimbursement for those things that they otherwise would not have to defend.
Sure. So what was interesting, Mr. about that case was that there had been a dispute whether when the endorsement says we'll cover the damages for any vehicle, trailer, truck, whatever, that the insurer's using, does that mean the duty to defend or just cover the liability? Because the policy at issue listed specific vehicles that were covered, and the vehicle here was not. This is not all in the Kennedy decision. This is in the companion case, which the Kennedy decision cites for the background. And that debate has gone on over the last 70 years. The federal rule is that if the endorsement doesn't obviate the underlying policy, so if there's no duty to defend in the underlying policy, then there's no duty to defend. You may have to pay damages. And the federal cases talking about Kennedy go on to say that California seems to be moving away from that and moving to the federal view. So that it's not even clear to me that Kennedy is even good law in the context of a public utility commission endorsement.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, maybe in the PUC context, but the language of the endorsement and how the court interpreted it, I think, is relevant and, again, has not been challenged and hasn't been overruled for 70 years, even though there's been
Hey, Mr. Let me ask this question. Let's assume that we don't think Kennedy is directly on point, or that we assume, as Judge Beatty indicated, that perhaps California seems to be moving in a different direction. Neither party addressed this. Should we certify this question to the California Supreme Court?
I would love for the court to certify, and I'm sure opposing counsel would probably want that as well, too, to get clarity associated with it. But in the absence of doing so, our view would be is the fact that the California Supreme Court would adopt the Kennedy decision, because there's no conflicting authority on that point. There is no other.
But what you're suggesting is that they follow Kennedy on the measure of damages for a breach of an insurance contract. And there's a legion of California Supreme Court decisions talking about what the measure of damages is, and that's to put the parties in the position they'd be without a breach. There's also statutory authority. California's adopted laws that say this is what your damages are. So in my view, you're asking us to apply Kennedy that's to something that's directly contrary to what the California Supreme Court has done.
Actually, the California Supreme Court, in cases where there is a defense and a payment here, I would disagree, Your Honor, that they're clear that
money
spent on defense and settlement is the proper measure.
Well, sure, but everything that you cited, all of those cases were general liability cases. They were comprehensive general liability coverage cases where the risk was transferred to the insurer. And the insured had paid for the insurer to pay for those costs, which is not what happened here. So I don't see any of those cases as being on point. But going back to certification, if you wanted certification, why didn't you ask for it? I mean, nobody filed a motion seeking certification, and this is the first we've heard your position that Yahoo would welcome that.
Well, I think that was in response to Judge Nelson's question regarding whether we would welcome that opportunity. Sure, we would definitely welcome it. I think the reason why didn't we brief it is because we believe Kennedy is good law, and that's something that the California Supreme Court would adopt. And just to address your question, Your Honor, is the fact that Kennedy is the only case that deals with the impact of measure of damages when there is such an endorsement, which I think is the critical aspect of why there are no other decisions other than Kennedy to go in that direction. So I think that is an important distinction to keep in mind.
If there were no bad faith, you would be entitled only to get your lawyer's fees, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What would you, if the jury found that Yahoo was entitled to the defense and that National Union breached by not giving its defense?
No, Your Honor. The court determined that National Union breached and that they had a duty to defend under the policy. That was not a jury question.
Right. Okay. And then your damage was that you fronted the money, right?
The damage was the fact that we, Yahoo, not National Union, defended the case. So I would disagree partly on the fronting idea because it's two different
cases. You incurred $600,000-some-odd in expense book.
No, Your Honor, we incurred $3 million to defend the underlying case and paid $2 million in settlement subject to the policy limits.
Wait, hold on. I want to get back to that. I'd understood there was $7 million at issue. You paid $3 million to defend the underlying and then $2 million to settle it.
We paid $4 million to settle, but $2 million is the policy limit.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So if we were to rule in your favor, you would only be entitled to $5 million, not $7 million, because of the policy limitation.
Correct, Your Honor. And those are stipulated
it's
amounts.
It's still a windfall. It's still a windfall. And that's, I think, what's given us some heartburn
sure.
in this case. So,
and Your Honor, I agree with that. I agree with the perception, but it doesn't change the actual language of the policy because if it was good...
Well, let me ask you this.
Dollar amount,
we've taken you way over, and we'll give the other side plenty of time because we haven't even covered a couple of the issues. We may have to bring you back on rebuttal for that. But does California adopt the first breach rule of a contract? Meaning, if a party breaches the contract in the first instance, it cannot then take advantage of the contract after the fact. Does California adopt that rule?
I don't know that it's called that way, but our position would be that it does from the standpoint of what the reciprocal obligation, if any, exists. And I would argue here that it's not a reciprocal obligation, it's a conditional obligation.
But is that the argument that you made? That's my concern is can we look to the first breach rule? Because you didn't cite to the first breach rule. And so is that argument waived or do you believe that that's encompassed within the arguments?
I certainly think it's encompassed because that's the conditional breach, the conditional obligation that we're talking about. And therefore the endorsement was never triggered because of the breach. So, even if it's not phrased that way, certainly the brief articulates that and conceptually applies that principle.
Okay. Well, I don't want to cut off questioning and we'll bring you back. I know you asked for 10 minutes for rebuttal. I don't know we'll give you that much, but we will give you time. We've taken you over. And I think at this point it might help to hear from opposing counsel. So
thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Emily Quatto on behalf of National Union. As the court's questioning to Mr. Has indicated, this case is about how to measure contract damages from breach of a fronting policy, which is a very unusual and atypical type of insurance product that Yahoo specifically negotiated to save over $200,000 on its insurance premiums. And I think excerpt of record, page 1867, shows just how deliberate Yahoo's choice was to enter into this type of policy that was effectively self-insurance at its primary layer. Because, this isn't just an add-on, as Yahoo has suggested. This was the defining feature of the policy. Yahoo's professional insurance broker went out to the market and shopped on Yahoo's behalf. National Union was the only company.
Well, how common are these fronting policies?
Very uncommon. And it's because you know, most of the time, you know, if an insured wants to self-insure, it can do so and then just purchase insurance on top of it. Here, for Yahoo's business reasons, it wanted a primary policy that basically functioned like a surety agreement to build an insurance tower on top of. Whatever the business reasons were for Yahoo to want to structure its risk management portfolio that way, that was the choice it deliberately made. And the
So let me ask you a question. The concern I have with your argument is if we adopt your reading of this policy, there is absolutely zero incentive for your company to ever comply. In fact, it almost invites a breach. Because if you, now we don't have this in this situation, Yahoo seems to be solvent, but if you had adopted this policy, presumably you take the risk of solvency into account. And if that company was insolvent, or you thought that it was a greater risk that they were insolvent than when you issued the policy, why wouldn't the rational decision be don't front the cost? Because your only risk at that point would be that they wouldn't pay you back. And so if you didn't pay that, all you'd be liable for, if we rule in your favor, is some marginal benefit of not fronting the cost. And why wouldn't that be your out every single time?
I have a couple of responses, Your Honor. The first is that because as between National Union and third parties that might have a claim against the policy would be in effect even if Yahoo was insolvent and National Union couldn't recoup. And the additional thing to keep in mind is that a deliberate decision not to defend when there is...
I want to drill down on that first point. So your position is you had duties, you would have had duty to pay to the third party the amount. So you would have stepped in to defend it so that you could make sure that the case was adequately defended.
Correct.
So that you didn't have to bear the burden on the back end.
Exactly. So, and if there were a judgment, National Union would be responsible in a lawsuit brought by the third party with an assignment, could recover the policy limits against National Union. And so really we're talking about damages only as between Yahoo and National Union. And the additional point I would make is that under the law of bad faith, a deliberate decision by National Union not to defend does subject National Union to bad faith liability. And that's exactly the claim that Yahoo made here, which gives it a right to extra contractual damages that it can prove were proximately caused by that deliberate decision not to defend when there should be coverage. And the other thing I would say is that just as a general matter, insurance companies like National Union have an incentive to make a proper, correct coverage determination so that the policy is interpreted consistently across policies and across insureds, especially when you're talking about coverage provisions where there might be a general liability policy, the vast majority of them that involve a first dollar defense duty that without a right to reimbursement. That's important for underwriting. So there's no incentive for National Union to deny coverage in bad faith under this policy.
Although that's apparently what happened, at least according to the jury.
Well, the jury found bad faith, but the primary argument that Yahoo advanced in the jury portion of the trial for bad faith actually has very little to do with the coverage decision for the Holland case. It had to do with a mistake made in underwriting about an endorsement to the policy, a different endorsement. It was undisputed that there was an error in underwriting. The policy was issued when it was bound. It wasn't complete, and that caused confusion in the claims process. That was the central point of Yahoo's bad faith claim, and you know, we didn't appeal the lack of causation between that mistake and any additional damages because the jury rightfully rejected Yahoo's claim to all of these additional damages it's seeking now as a windfall measure of damages on the contract claim.
So what about Yahoo's argument that there were a number of other things that had to happen? This was not so simple that the insurance company would front the money and then they got the reimbursement back. They had to request reimbursement. There might have been other things that had to be done. Why should we assume that those other things would have been complied with? Meaning the insurance company could have not requested certain things, and we never know what would have happened. And in that circumstance, Yahoo might have gotten $5 million of benefit out of this contract. And we don't know how that played out because the contract was breached.
I don't think there's any counterfactual universe where anything National Union did would have caused the transfer of that $5 million to
Well, there absolutely is. Maybe the insurance company doesn't send the bills out or request the repayment.
Well, that would be, I mean, that would be National Union basically waiving its rights under the contract. And here, this case is about Yahoo suing National Union to measure its damages. And the other thing I should make sure...
But my only point is there is a scenario under which Yahoo could have received $5 million out of this.
Not based on the way that the contract is written.
I don't agree with that. I mean, we all acknowledge that there were certain things that insurance company had to do in order to receive reimbursement.
Well, I think at trial, the testimony was that the reimbursement process was automatic. So the second National Union paid an invoice, it automatically generated an invoice to Yahoo to pay it back. There was really, I mean, yes, there was a process for the reimbursement obligation, but it didn't require any deliberate decision by National Union about whether it was entitled to that reimbursement or not. And I think another thing to keep in mind is that National Union agreed to defend under a reservation of rights before this case was ever even filed. So National Union was...
How much money had been expended, if you know, before they exercised their reservation of rights?
I believe almost all of it. I can't remember offhand now whether the settlement...
Well, so then what does the reservation of rights really mean?
Well, National Union disclaimed coverage. Yahoo wrote about over 2 years later to request reconsideration. National Union granted it, said, "Well, defend, please send us the invoices." And I think there was also an issue about when precisely the settlement was paid. But, the reservation of rights is something that the insurer is required to issue if it doesn't want to waive its coverage defenses. And that did entitle Yahoo, as Judge Beatty recognized, to independent counsel. And it is true that Yahoo retained Morrison & Foerster and a Washington, D.C. privacy specialist to defend it against the Svetha Company litigation before it tendered any of the claims to National Union. And so this was always a case where Yahoo was going to have independent counsel. It was going to have the counsel of its choosing in order to defend it against this very important claim, which is one of the benefits of having a primary policy that's effectively self-insurance. And National Union is getting, National Union issued the reservation of rights. If it had paid, it then would have demanded reimbursement from Yahoo, which is why National Union...
Well, I guess I would be more sympathetic to your argument if you'd issued the reservation of rights up front, but you didn't. So I'm not sure why you're making a point now that you're entitled to come back in and Yahoo somehow acted inappropriately in not sending you invoices for a claim that you had already affirmatively said you didn't have any duty to defend.
Right. Well, so... if National Union had issued a coverage position letter, accepting coverage with a reservation of rights 2 years earlier, the situation between the parties would be the same. And ultimately, the question is, what is the damage to Yahoo from that delay? And the only damage to Yahoo under the contract is the time value of money it lost by having to pay its attorneys directly rather than having to pay the exact same amounts to National Union 30 days or less later. The district court's measure of contract damages fits within the California law that says a party is entitled to the benefit of its bargain, not more. And as your honor...
The benefit of the bargain, I'm inclined to agree with you, but what about the first breach rule? And that's what keeps getting me hung up here, is you breach the contract to not even take the first position that you would now agree you needed to do, which was front the cost. So if you breach that contract, why are you then able, because California law does adopt the first breach rule, why are you then able to rely upon the rest of the contract? That seems to be counter to the first breach rule under California law.
Because Yahoo is before this court asking it to award damages per the terms of the policy. So if National Union were the plaintiff here, it would be a different story. But Yahoo is asserting, a right to make National Union pay, to make National Union cure that breach. And once it has done so, then Yahoo can't ignore the reciprocal obligations it would have had.
No, I don't think that's right at all. The first breach rule is once a party breaches the contract, the rest of the obligations fall away.
If the
insurance company breached the contract in the first instance, the contract is then null and void. And you have a duty to rectify that breach. You're now trying to say, we don't want to fully rectify that, or in fully rectifying that breach, we want to rely on a provision of the contract that under the first breach rule would already be null and void.
I disagree that that's the way that the policy works and the way that California law makes has determines damages. Because here, the way that damages are determined, it is the net value to the non-breaching party of the value of the contract being performed by both sides. So that's how you measure damages. And it's not about whether or not National Union then can enforce other portions of the agreement after it has breached. This is about how...
So your position would be the first breach rule may apply as to obligations under the contract, but you can't use the first breach rule in any way to determine the damages portion of the breach.
Right. When Yahoo is the plaintiff here seeking to have its damages calculated based on enforcement, because what Yahoo is really seeking to do is ask this court to enforce only half of the policy and not measure damages by the value of the full performance on both sides so that it's not just made whole, it gets to leverage the breach in order to obtain a massive windfall it never would have gotten absent the breach. California law does not support that type of result.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
This breach was not a repudiation of the insurance contract, was it?
Exactly. It wasn't a repudiation of the insurance contract. The contract remained void or valid for any other claims that Yahoo might tender.
I've not studied the first breach rule, but would the first breach rule apply to a situation of a breach that was not a repudiation?
Your Honor, I also have not studied it in depth because Yahoo didn't assert that as a basis for its claims in this case. But yeah, I would think if we're not repudiating the contract, it's just a question of damages for breach under one circumstance within a policy that would still be in effect otherwise.
How is repudiation defined in California law? How is it different from breach?
Well, I don't have that offhand, but I would anticipate just based on black letter contract law that it would be National Union saying that, you know, basically where the remedy here would be rescission rather than just damages.
So we're all at a bit of a disadvantage because this wasn't brief, but what I understood from some of the cases I was reading is that if the insurer breaches the contract because they failed to provide a defense that they're supposed to provide, they can't then say, oh, and by the way, you didn't give us notice, you know, things like other contract provisions. But does that mean that essentially the contract doesn't exist anymore, and now Yahoo gets damages for coverage they never paid for, and it was never anticipated.
Exactly. I mean, if Yahoo's position is National Union's breach repudiated the contract, then there's no contractual basis to transfer any liability onto National Union, because National Union's responsibility would be defined by the risk transfer nature of the agreement. You know, it's not like National Union caused these lawsuits to be filed. National Union's liability is limited by the risk transfer provided by the contract. If that contract is out the window, if it's been repudiated, if that's Yahoo's position, then I think it's clear National Union owes, you know, no responsibilities to Yahoo under the contract because there's no basis left to transfer the liability.
But National Union could have significant liability in tort, in bad faith.
Correct. Yes. And, you know, of course, this exact claim went to the jury on the tort theory, and the jury rejected it. And I think that shows the lack of causation about these defense costs because they were never transferred onto National Union.
Well, let me get one question, then we'll let you go on because I know you have some other issues. And I think we've kind of taken ourselves out of the time constraints. So what we asked Yahoo's counsel about certification. What do you agree that, given sort of the uniqueness of this contract provision and the lack of case law that kind of guides us in this area, that certification might be something we should consider?
No, I don't think certification is necessary here, and I don't think it would be appropriate. I don't think it would meet the criteria for review because Kennedy is not on point because it's about duty, not how you measure damages from breach of a policy like this one, whatever the parameters of that other policy were, if the opinion isn't clear. And the basic rules of how you measure contract damages are a matter of black letter California law that this court, I think, can easily apply without prolonging the litigation further and sending it to the California Supreme Court that doesn't need to resolve the issue of this very unusual type of policy. I think just applying the basic rules of contract damages showed that the district court's order was the only logical way to make Yahoo whole without giving it a windfall, and that's ultimately what the California law of contract damages attempts to do. And so I think this court should have no difficulty affirming just based on the very basic contract rules that we cited in our briefing. So I would be happy to answer further questions on the deductible coverage endorsement, but I think the court understands our position that it's just would be a windfall measure of damages that's not appropriate given Yahoo's very deliberate decision to structure its policy this way, and that the court shouldn't restructure the deal to grant Yahoo coverage it refused and deliberately chose not to pay for. With the few minutes I have left, I would like to turn to our cross-appeal on the issue of grant fees, which I think is also pretty straightforward. There's no dispute that in the very inception of both contractual and extra-contractual claims were at issue, and under the California Supreme Court's decision in Brandt and the subsequent cases Cassim and so forth, an insured who wants to recover grant fees has an obligation to allocate those fees between those grant permits to be recovered and those grant does not permit to be recovered, and Yahoo did not offer that type of evidence, and the consequence of that failure of proof is judgment for National Union on that claim. Decision in Slotta.
Well, before you get to Slotto, Teleflex Medical Incorporated, this is 851 F3rd 976, a 2017 decision by the Ninth Circuit, specifically says National Union's argument that the district court was required to deny all unsegregated fees, speaking of brand fees, is plainly contrary to California law providing for apportionment of brand fees. Can you help me distinguish that case from this? Because that would seem to suggest that your argument goes a bit too far on why brand fees should just be outright denied.
Well, brand fees, you know, the point is it was Yahoo's burden to present the evidence that would permit a segregation. And if it had presented that sort of
I disagree with you. Hold on, back up. I don't think it was their responsibility to submit evidence that supported brand fees. They did that. Now, the debate here is, well, you put in too much. But the cases that you're relying on are where no evidence was submitted. And it seems to me Teleflex is the one that says, hey, where there's evidence in there that includes both segregated fees and unsegregated fees, or coverable fees and uncoverable fees, it's plainly contrary to California law, which provides for an apportionment of brand fees. So, I mean, why wasn't it your duty to go in and argue about which fees shouldn't have been awarded?
Because Yahoo had to present a competent witness that we could have examined on that question, and it chose not to. Because we can't segregate fees. We have no ability to do that because we didn't perform the work. And so in order to meet its prima facie burden...
Wait. I don't think that's a fair rendition of what happened here. They put forward a witness who could tell you what the fees were for. I don't think they had to put forward a witness who understood which were covered and which weren't. He could have explained... You were able to ask any question about what these fees were about. And I don't mean to say you. I don't know if you were representing them below. But the insurance company's counsel was able to cross-examine him on anything about those fees. So they didn't make an argument to the jury, as I understand it, that some of these fees were not recoverable.
Well, I think if you look at four excerpt of record 804, five excerpt of record 873 to 874, and five excerpt of record 875 to 876, it's clear that Tepstein, the witness they had, lacked foundation to answer those very basic questions. And if National Union's counsel had asked those questions, it essentially would have been waiving the lack of foundation, speculative, and hearsay objections that it would have raised had Yahoo tried to offer it, because Tepstein simply wasn't the competent witness to answer those questions with adequate foundation. And we did, you know, we tried to argue it, and I should say also, you know, of course, National Union has alternative arguments for a new trial, because if there was a burden on National Union here, we tried to offer an expert. We tried to get that deposition in advance, and we tried to get a jury instruction that would have allowed us to make a more coherent argument to the jury about segregation.
So I'm interested in your jury instruction argument, because it does appear that the district court gave the wrong jury instruction. And yes, the National Union requested a different jury instruction. What do we do if we believe that the jury instruction were improper? Your position is we should just use that improper jury instruction to strike out Brandt fees, or do we need to instruct the district court to take another look at this and redo, the jury, I guess?
It would be a remand for a limited retrial on the amount of Brandt fees with a properly instructed jury. You know, my primary argument is that under Slotto, which says that a sophisticated party, especially like Yahoo, is not entitled to a second try to present allocation evidence it should have presented the first time. But if the court rejects that and thinks that Yahoo had enough, the instructional error is an independent basis to reverse for a new trial, because the jury was not instructed to do that sort of segregation that the court would say that we should have argued. We couldn't do that without the additional instructional language that made clear that the Yahoo was not entitled to 100% of what it claimed if the jury found that a portion of those fees should have been allocated to bad faith or to Yahoo's unsuccessful efforts to recover that under the deductible coverage endorsement. So that would be a limited new trial, either a jury trial, or the parties, you know, can stipulate to a court trial, although we did prefer to have a jury trial on this issue, but that's something that would have to be decided on remand as a result of the instructional error that resulted in what is prime on its face an excessive award of Brandt fees at a minimum.
So does it matter whether it was the court that was deciding the Brandt fees or whether it was the jury? And in part, I ask because I know that Brandt encourages the parties to have the court apply its expertise and decide the issue. It's not mandated, and of course the parties have a right to take it to a jury. But in Teleflex, which neither of you cited, neither party cited that in the briefing, the court was making the determination, and it found intertwined fees for both the bad faith and the insurance claim and awarded like 10%. It made the allocation. Here, as I understand the record, Yahoo put in over 114 pages of billing, and then argued, and I went and read the argument transcript, just argued flat out all of these fees are covered. And when you look at the billing, clearly some of them say they're billing for bad faith. So there's no allocation evidence presented. They say everything's covered, and the jury's the one who's supposed to make this decision versus Teleflex where the judge was doing that. I mean, does that matter? Do you think there's any distinction there?
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a couple of responses. So I don't think in terms of Yahoo meeting its burden of proof in this circumstance, the trier of fact mattered, because I believe Yahoo was responsible for presenting a competent witness who could do that allocation for the court. But for the reason you mentioned, at least the court has some additional basis to evaluate the fees, having presided over the case, to look at the fees and figure out about how much of the case was really about litigating bad faith and unsuccessful coverage issues versus what it awarded. So in Teleflex, it might have been the district court was in a better position to actually make that determination. A lay jury is certainly not in that position. And so because the case was tried to the jury without a competent witness, you can't hand 100 pages of invoices to a jury and ask them to do an allocation based on what Brandt requires, especially.
I get the sense that this was poorly pre-tried, that more discovery and more pointed discovery would have been better for both sides.
We agree, but we didn't have the invoices until the eve of trial because Yahoo was standing on its privilege objection not to produce them. The district court determined that that was a Rule 26 violation and that Yahoo had to produce them to us on a rolling basis. Once we became informed by Yahoo that it was complete with its production, we then sought to do a discovery deposition, and Yahoo, again, did not offer counsel who prepared the invoices. He offered Mr. Tepstein, and we didn't.
You have opportunities to seek relief in the district court.
We did.
You could have made the trial. You could have expanded the record. You could have asked for more depositions. And
we
so
did, all, Your Honor. We did all of those things, and the district court denied our requests. We requested a deposition. I think at one point we requested a trial continuance, and we filed multiple motions seeking to either preclude the fees or.
But you were late in doing that.
The only reason we were late in doing that is because Yahoo had been standing on its privilege objection, and as long as Yahoo wasn't going to produce the evidence to support its fee claim, our position, we didn't need to do any discovery because the claim would have been precluded.
And how could it prove the claim without showing the evidence for the claim?
It couldn't do that, and our position was, since we thought that's what Yahoo was going to do, there was going to be no claim, and it wasn't until shortly before trial.
That doesn't make sense, does it? If they're going to have a claim for damages because of fees, they've got to prove their fees. They can't just get the fees on a say-so.
I agree, Your Honor, and because Yahoo was refusing to disclose the evidence of its fees claiming privilege, we thought that they weren't going to be able to meet their burden of proof, and it wasn't until the district court decided to order them to disclose the fees and sit for deposition that there was going to be any evidence to support that claim, and that only happened shortly.
There was a flurry of last-minute activity that should have been done a lot earlier.
Well,
Ms. Carter, is your argument on the jury instruction that the instruction was flat out erroneous or that it just wasn't clear enough, it wasn't emphatic enough? Because the instruction said the cost of reasonable attorney's fees incurred to obtain policy benefits, which is a correct statement of California law. But it didn't go on to say, but don't consider other things. It didn't include sort of more emphasis. So does that make it incorrect as a matter of California law, or do you just think it could have been better? It could have been more clear.
I believe that makes it incorrect as a matter of California law because Brandt specifies that the jury needs to be instructed on that critical limitation, because as given, the instruction basically says if there's a but-for causal relationship between whatever fees they ask for and the bad faith, you can award whatever they've requested, and the jury needs to be instructed on that limitation to know that it can do some sort of segregation or some sort of limitation. And so because the instruction only reflected half of the Brandt rule, I think it was erroneous as a matter of law.
The district court seemed to recognize that it wasn't fully compliant with the recommended jury instructions, but it did seem to couch it in discretion as to why, and I forget the answer now, maybe you can help refresh me, as to why he didn't feel like your requested jury instruction needed to be used. Isn't there some discretion for the district court to tailor the recommended jury instructions and help me understand why this was a pure legal error because he deviated from the recommended jury instruction versus, in the totality of circumstances, it made sense in this case.
The reason the district court didn't give the full instruction is because he thought that that additional language would be confusing because Yahoo was asserting its claim for the $3.5 million in attorney's fees as bad faith damages. And I don't think that that claim should have gone to the jury. We moved for Rule 50 because it wasn't causally related to anything National Union did. And so it decided to, exercise its discretion to not give a full instruction based on what I think was an erroneous decision underlying the claims that were going to the jury. But regardless, I even offered alternative language to try to cure that confusion because the limitation is critical. And without the limitation, I think it's an error of law under Brandt because attorney's fees under Brandt are damages. They're economic damages that have to be proved with precision. And the jury needs to understand the limitation. Otherwise, it's just going to award whatever it sees on the invoices. And so, I think Brandt requires that language, and I think it was an error of law not to give it.
You highlight one of the interesting aspects to the Brandt fees, which is you took the unusual step. You're well within your right, or the insurance company, well within the right, but took the unusual step to require this to go to the jury. And now the complaint seems to be, well, the jury wasn't really capable of performing its function. So, there's a little bit of tension between the strategy that was engaged in here, it seems.
Well, I think it's not intention, Your Honor. It's because our view is that Yahoo had to carry its burden before the jury, and it didn't do so. And the way that it had...
Wait, hold on. But they did. They did bear their burden. They not only carried their burden, but they went way beyond it, right? I mean, that's the argument here. The cases that you're relying on are where a party truly doesn't bear its burden and doesn't submit anything. Here, they over-disclose. And, the concern I have about going your way on this issue is that there's always going to be a debate, right? What if Yahoo, they submitted 100% of them. What if Yahoo had made a first cut and they submitted only 75%? And they said, look, we you would have still been in here arguing, no way, those 75% of the invoices aren't recoverable. So you still over-disclosed. You would be making the same argument. So you're sort of trying to argue that Yahoo needs to be exactly precise or else they're not entitled to any fees.
I think the difference is that in that circumstance where Yahoo had attempted some sort of allocation, it would have had to have a witness to explain that, and that's the piece that's, I think, missing from, you know, it's where we and Yahoo fundamentally disagree. Did a competent witness who did the allocation need to testify on Yahoo's behalf and answer those questions about why, about how they've allocated the fees? And I think that that is very clear to be Yahoo's burden. And I think the district court decision in the Celerity case we cited in our brief, I know it's a district court decision, but the California federal courts deal with this issue frequently, and they're, I think, pretty uniform in how they deal with it. On page 11, it says the following. The fact that the invoices may have included some of the grant fees which plaintiff seeks to recover without any more information establishing that plaintiff adequately identified or segregated the fees as required by Brandt is insufficient to withstand summary judgment. So too is it insufficient to withstand judgment as a matter of law. It wouldn't have been burdensome for Yahoo to meet its burden. We just needed a witness who could have answered the question about how it was allocated.
Well, I actually disagree with you. Where that seems to fall apart. I mean, number one, it seems to be in tension with Ninth Circuit law. And with all due respect, we'll follow Ninth Circuit law over a district court case. But also, in that case, it was summary judgment. They couldn't get summary judgment. But that didn't mean, hold on. So the district court then granted summary judgment to the insurance company in that case?
On the Brandt claim. Even, I think, a stronger showing.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you. Okay. All right. I think we've taken you over your time. I don't want to cut any, if either of the other judges have further questions, we'll keep at it. But.
No.
Okay, I think we have your argument, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. We'll give you 5 minutes, and we'll start there and see where we get to.
That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. And why don't I work backwards to address more of the recency on the cross-appeal. So one factual note that I think is really critical that's important to address here is Yahoo did not submit 100% of its brand fees to or its attorney's fees in the case. To be clear, it submitted up through July of 2018, even though the trial of this case didn't get completed until May of 2019. So,
well, but that doesn't really seem to answer the question. That just means you voluntarily withdrew and didn't submit some fees that you would have perhaps been entitled to.
No,
but there's an important. Oh, go ahead.
Here's the important point, though. With all due respect, is the idea that Yahoo allocated by submitting what it believed was appropriate brand fees, because up until that point, that's when Yahoo obtained the benefits under the policy, i.e. a determination that there had been a breach of duty under the policy, and that the remainder of the case, even though there would be issues about damages that would be fall into the brand category, look more like it would be bad faith because we were going to a jury on bad faith. So the notion that Yahoo didn't allocate, first of all, the case
but you agree, okay,
but it's already done.
But you agree now that looking at those invoices, it was over-inclusive and that some of those invoices would not be recoverable fees.
As in every fee petition, there will be items that go through, and in fact, the balancing, going to sort of what the court was doing, was that the National Union had that opportunity. Obviously, because the witness that we presented was competent, as you had understood, that they knew exactly what was happening in the case. And so their credibility could be challenged in terms of what was done. And the jury wasn't given an option to either award all $618,000 or zero. It literally was given all those pages so that they could line item and say, this is no good, this is no good, no good. And they had to write in.
Well, but they didn't. It seems like the problem was twofold. Number one, they weren't properly instructed by the district court in how to make that allocation. And number two, boy, that seems like a very difficult job for a jury to do. And I know that's not your fault. You didn't request the jury. But, you know, it's difficult to expect a jury to come to a conclusion on what's a pretty complicated legal question, ultimately.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, on that issue. But again, I think the important part is this is what the choice that they wanted and they pushed. And what the judge did was balance those issues. And the jury instruction idea was again, it's on an abuse of discretion standard, which is very
important.
Well,
that's what I want to know. Is it on abuse of discretion? Because it does seem like there was error. I mean, usually it's error if you don't follow the recommended jury instruction. Now, he gave a reason here. So, I mean, do we look at that reason and say, well, we review that for abuse of discretion and whether his reason was justified in departing from the traditional jury instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. It is absolutely an abuse of discretion because the court has to balance what was happening in the case, what information was being set forth, and the reason the court went in the direction that it did was that it was going to create potentially confusion the other direction and confuse the jury because there were other attorney's fees that Yahoo was seeking. And so that was the balancing that was done. And then also the judge gave greater leeway for...
Can you explain that? Can you explain why it would be confusing?
Well, because Yahoo was seeking other attorney's fees in the case. Attorney's fees meaning the defense of the underlying case. So we had $3 million in attorney's fees.
That was the $3 million.
Yes. And so
Sorry, just to clarify, I thought opposing counsel had said $3.5 million. We can go look at it, but was it $3 million or $3.5 million that you were?
$3,048,598, Your Honor.
Okay.
And 27 cents.
Yeah. So that really was the balancing, and the court gave counsel a lot of leeway to argue those points at closing. And also with the cross-examination of the witness. And all of these things are an abuse of discretion because what we're really asking, what they're asking to do, is to basically undo the jury verdict. And that has to be a much higher bar, and the standard of review is much higher. And let me just address one final thing before I just address a rebuttal on the opening, is that all along, both parties were in agreement that this issue would be done by the district court judge, like in every other case, after conclusion of the case, for all the reasons that we talked about. That's one of the reasons why no experts were designated. We had agreements regarding how the invoices would be produced, all of that. And that was a conscious decision that National Union made to upend that 2 weeks before trial was getting started. So they didn't put experts on their witness list. They didn't produce any of the information that they wanted to pursue. And again, it's not an excuse, but I wanted to provide that context because
Mr. Umar, I think that is significant because National Union's argument that Yahoo was claiming privilege over the invoices made it seem as if Yahoo was doing something nonsensical because you weren't producing your evidence instead of claiming privilege. But what you're saying is the understanding or the agreement was that this evidence would be produced, but in some fashion to protect privilege, attorney's eyes only, in camera, something. You weren't, if I understand what you're saying, you weren't going to assert privilege over your bills and then try to recover fees.
Sure, no, absolutely. And again, the process here is if it's before the judge and the case is over, now you don't have any work product that's going back on an active case that's going forward. So that is done on a consistent basis because we're actively litigating this case with opposing counsel. That's the attorney's fees that were at issue. So
what point,
to produce them on a...
At what point was it decided to have a jury trial?
So the case was scheduled for trial probably late January of 2019. We had final pretrial submissions, and that's when they stepped in to say that they wanted to put this before the jury. And we had briefing and arguments associated with that.
So it left very little time for discovery of these issues.
Well, the trial did get moved to May, so there was time in between for depositions, and the court did allow for depositions to take place.
Your opponent says there wasn't enough time.
I would take issue with that because we had a witness ready to go to produce it, start with Mr. Tepstein, and then if they wanted others, they certainly could have, but they chose not to go forward with Mr. Tepstein's deposition voluntarily. And again, I raise this because it's important that the court understand
that it could require the company to produce the witness that would speak to the issues.
Well, if that was necessary, we obviously don't believe it's necessary to do it that way because we believe we put a competent witness who's familiar with the case, familiar with how the cases was being litigated, and knew enough of the details to provide the jury to make its determination. And Brandt simply requires that you present your case, and it's up to them to decide. They were in 1/10th increments. If you look at the invoices, you'll see you could go day by day. There are activities that are to the 0.1 of an hour, and the jury can go through that, tedious as it might be. So, again, I think it's important to look at the abuse of discretion standard when you're considering all of this. And there is all kinds of information, including pretrial delays, including jury instructions and potential confusion. But if you put it all in totality of evidence, the trial court balanced those issues and exercises discretion to reach the verdict that it did.
But when even under the abuse of discretion standard that you argue, we review whether the instruction was legally erroneous de novo, correct? So whether the instruction as a matter of law was correct is a de novo issue.
We don't believe that that's the case when it comes to not a major issue like a burden of proof, for example, on a jury instruction. That would be de novo because it's a major issue as to which party had the burden of proof. But in an issue like here where the instruction was, as I think Your Honor, Judge Beatty had mentioned, was that the jury instruction had a correct articulation of Brandt. It said award reasonable attorney's fees to get the policy benefits, which is the Brandt standard. And the only issue is but nothing else. And the but nothing else seems to be superfluous. And if it was a violation of the jury instruction, then that would be harmless error because you're talking about other attorney's fees that were being sought in that context. So I would submit that is an abuse of discretion standard, whether you determine that additional language and excluding it was appropriate or not.
But what if we say that the insurance company's proposal would have better alleviated that problem? I guess then we're still in an abuse of discretion review, and we have to be convinced that really, you know, it would have been clearly erroneous not to include the suggested language. Not just that we think that the district court should have, but it would have been clearly erroneous not to include it.
Yes, Your Honor. It would be abuse of discretion because, again, the standard language and the articulation was appropriate, and that's not disputed, that the Brandt standard was articulated in the jury instruction, and the additional item would have created additional confusion if the judge had ordered it.
Okay.
If I can just go back to the case. First on the point about the fact that we're talking about $5 million here, $3 million for defense, $2 million for settlement because of the policy limit. That's kind of the problem. It could be much lower than the $3 million. It could have been much higher than that if National Union had defended the case. And that's a very critical, important point that's out there. And I just want to remind the court that we're certainly getting hung up on those numbers.
Hold that back up. How would it have changed if National Union would have defended the case? You had the best counsel out there. Like, it's not like you suffered by having to get a lesser counsel.
No. And that's important to know that we're not talking about us suffering, and there's no positions here about whether the defense was done appropriately. But if National Union had defended, and really important to note at the outset, they could deny, they could accept, they can defend without a reservation, with the reservation right. They chose option one to deny. Had they accepted, they could have accepted without reservation. They would have appointed their insurance counsel that they typically get in these settings. And one argument is that they would have gotten them at lower rates and otherwise. And so they could have defended.
Oh, I see. You're talking about the three million. Could have been less.
Yeah,
that's
and I'm not quibbling with
speculative on the record because none of that happened, and in fact, Yahoo wanted to select its counsel, and it did so. It interviewed four firms and picked counsel it wanted before even tendering the defense, so it got exactly what it wanted.
So,
and as you noted, they could have reserved rights, and so it's fully anticipated that they could have defended on a reservation of rights with Kinjahu, who would have had independent counsel.
And I think that's that is the point here. It is, all of it is speculative, and the fact that we're being that the court seemed concerned about the dollar amount at issue, I'm simply addressing. That happened to be the case here. It didn't necessarily have to be. And I would submit it could have been a lot higher, okay, under the circumstances. And so,
but did you put in any evidence? I know you were, Yahoo was pleased with their counsel. They got a great result in the first two cases, and then they hired them again. So they clearly liked what they were doing. But did you put in evidence that they paid more in attorney's fees than they otherwise would have if Yahoo had, had paid the fees first?
Again, it is so speculative, it's virtually impossible to do. We did try to submit evidence that, that when insurers typically defend these cases, that they have hourly rates that are much lower in typical cases, but the court prevented us from introducing that information. So the short answer is yes, but I don't think it's relevant other than...
But that only goes to the $3 million for attorney's fees. That really, you're not arguing, the $2 million that was paid out under the settlement, that's a different issue. That wouldn't have, it wouldn't have had an impact on that.
And again, I don't want to dwell upon it because I don't think it's germane necessarily, but the case settled by our defense. So the case defended by somebody else could have resulted in a different settlement, judgment, or the like. So we'll take the facts as they are, but I just want to clarify that. The second one is to address your question. You had a good point, Judge Nelson, is could we have walked away, could National Union have walked away and Yahoo ended up with $5 million? And we're not indicating here that they wouldn't have sent us an invoice. So let's just take that as a given. But if they had sent us an invoice, if we went through this process normally, Yahoo also had rights under the endorsement. Yahoo could have withheld reimbursing that money, that $5 million.
Well, that's, yeah, but under what grounds? Because, I mean, where I get hung up is the solvency issue. Because that seems to, I honestly, for the life of me, still can't figure out why Yahoo entered into this insurance policy, but I mean, I get it. There's business reasons, whatever. But the real business reason to enter into a policy like this is if you fear insolvency, if a company fears insolvency, and they wouldn't, you know, otherwise be able to pay counsel, and then
I think it may be required to show insurance. I don't think Yahoo's taking out policies to protect itself from insolvency here.
That seems to be clear, but that's still
require insurance, and this is a form of satisfying those requirements.
Is that what it was? That this was a cheaper way of satisfying the insurance requirements that Yahoo had?
Actually, the underwriting was not an issue here, so I don't want to speculate on the details surrounding it because it wasn't.
Well, and ultimately, it doesn't matter. I mean, they entered into the contract; we have to interpret it as it is.
Right,
The reason
I think on that point is Yahoo could default under the endorsement, and it has its own default and remedy provision in there that says that if you fail to perform, and this is at ER 624, and if you, Yahoo, fail to perform your duties, which is the reimbursement, we, National Union, may take any reasonable steps necessary to protect our interests. And the remedies that they're provided is that they can cancel the endorsement or the policies to which the endorsement applies. So, again, that didn't happen, and we won't know whether it was.
Well, but they also, hold on, they also could have sued Yahoo to recover the reimbursement.
But, arguably, yes, and we could have had then the defense.
Are you really arguing that they couldn't have done that because of the what's on ER 624 that was their only recourse?
No, but I'm saying is that the best way to interpret what the party's understanding of how the endorsement was going to work is to look to the actual language of the endorsement that's part of the policy and what it allowed it to do. And if the scenario played out, and again, I'm not talking just simply about, oh, they didn't send us an invoice.
Yeah. Right?
Is that Yahoo could have taken these decisions and could have decided, is it worth not paying for reimbursement for whatever grounds there might be? Who knows? It, you know, inefficiency of the defense, paid too much, whatever the situation may be. But the point being that Yahoo had rights and obligations under the policy.
Right. So Yahoo could breach as well. I mean, both parties to the contract could breach, right?
Absolutely.
So what you're laying out is a possibility where Yahoo breached the contract, and we have a completely different case. We have the flip side. We have National Union suing Yahoo for the breach rather than Yahoo suing National Union for the breach. And then we'd be looking at damages in a, you know, what are the damages for Yahoo's breach? But as we talked about earlier, under California law, the damages are to put the parties in the position they would have been if both parties performed, right? Not speculating that we're going to give you damages, speculating that, you know, National Union breached and so do we. The law on the statutes and in the Supreme Court decisions is clear. We're trying to put the parties in the position they would be in if there was mutual performance.
Well, I would submit if you went through that process, one of the performances is the fact that National Union could have canceled the endorsement. So we can be in a situation here where we didn't reimburse them, they canceled the endorsement and the policy, meaning the policy no longer exists. They void the policy at that point forward. And again, I'm not just making this up. It's some.
No, I understand. I'm having a hard time understanding how that helps our decision making.
Yeah, I'm having a hard understanding how that's relevant because it's just not our case. You know, National Union could have gone bankrupt. Yahoo could have gone bankrupt. Yahoo could have been sold to another entity. I mean, none of those things happen, so it's not our case.
But here's why, Your Honors, that it's important. The reason why it's important is because of the fact that the policy language has to dictate how you remedy breach of contract here, and breach of duty, and the breach of to pay. Is that the remedy that was fashioned by the court is not supported by the endorsement. The endorsement doesn't allow the remedy that was fashioned by the court, and it also is not supported by the case law, which going back to Kennedy.
Explain that to me. Explain that. If the policy had been followed, National Union would have incurred certain amount of expenses by way of defense and settlement, and they would be reimbursed by Yahoo. So what are you gaining? What should
Yahoo would have had the choice to reimburse or not.
If the policy has been implemented according to its terms, what would you be gaining?
Yahoo would have had the choice whether to reimburse National Union or not. And
that's
the
an
point
obligation.
Of which is that these are separate.
You had no choice.
Separate obligations under the policy.
An obligation under the policy.
Your Honor, just to go to another case to think about, there are obligations under the policies to give notice, for example, to get the insurer's consent before you settle the case. Well, if you fail to do either of those things, you could end up losing, you know, millions of dollars worth of coverage just by failing to do one or two of those conditions.
Basics of this policy.
We would submit that this endorsement is different.
And is reimbursed. They're correlative rights and obligations. You can't think of one without the other. And in this this context, National Union chose not to perform its part of the bargain under a claim of right, perhaps, but that's what it did. Yahoo advanced the money. But in any event, Yahoo would have had to reimburse National Union. So it can't come off better than it would be if the contract were formed. This is not a tort case, it's a contract case. You got the benefit of your bargain.
We agree that it's not a tort case, but what the court is doing is putting National Union in the exact same position as if it actually performed under the policy.
Exactly. That's exactly what California case law requires us to do. Put the parties in the position they would have been in if there had been mutual performance. What you're suggesting
Except for one big thing, though, Your Honor, is they are...
Well, you're suggesting that Yahoo could breach, and they could have. And if Yahoo had breached, we'd have a different case, and they could be sued for the breach. But that's not what happened. So the fact that Yahoo can also breach doesn't change the measure of damages.
No, I'm saying is that National Union is being put in the same position as if they didn't breach. And that's a pretty fundamental point.
Okay, I take your point.
They're paying damages, but they're not. They did pay damages, something like they paid $500,000, which included other damages, but they also paid interest and they paid prejudgment interest on the interest. So they're not in exactly the same position they would have been if there was no breach. granted, these are minimal damages, but that is what Yahoo negotiated for. They got the benefit of their bargain. They paid very little for very little coverage. And even though they didn't get a whole lot of money out of this, that's okay. That's what the contract provided.
So fair enough. And my final point on that would be is we haven't talked about the fact that the court committed error by relying upon a payment agreement that's not even part of the policy. I'll let the court sort of...
I think we have, at least on that point, we're comfortable with your briefing.
Right. And the final point would be is that just to follow up on the suggestion about certification, I do think it could be because of all the questions that we've had here in terms of going back and forth. But the certification would need to be narrowed to the issue about what are the appropriate measure of damages when there exists an endorsement such as a reimbursement re-endorsement when the insurance carrier breached that obligation. And it doesn't need to go further than that aspect of it. And we would submit that the Kennedy decision is the only decision that's out there and could require some clarification if that would benefit the court.
Okay. Absent further questions, I think we've gotten a pretty good explanation of what this case is about, and we appreciate both counsel's efforts in that regard, and we'll submit the case, and we're concluded for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This court for this session stands adjourned.